You solve the diagnostic puzzle, but what happens after you prescribe? Amazon Pharmacy helps your patients start treatment faster with same-day delivery, transparent pricing, and 24/7 pharmacist support. Because the best diagnosis means nothing without medication access. Learn more at pharmacy.amazon.com/prescribers.
Welcome back, clinical problem solvers. Maddie and Yusuf here. At CP Solvers, our mission is to make clinical reasoning accessible to learners worldwide. We invite you to join us for our live virtual morning reports, where we break down cases and sharpen our diagnostic reasoning together. Now over to you, Yusuf.
Thanks, Maddie. Just a quick reminder, this podcast is for educational purposes only and is not a substitute for medical advice. Patient details have been modified to protect their privacy, and the views expressed here are our own, not those of our employers. Now, let's dive into the case.
Enjoy the show!
Welcome back, clinical problem solvers, to another episode of Women in Diagnosis Series, WDX. It's so good to be back. This time we're doing a clinical unknown. Kaylin and I are in the hot seat and we have an awesome returning guest. Kushal, I'm so, so happy that you're joining us. Do you want to just reintroduce yourself? And yeah, and then we'll get going.
Thanks, Sharmeen, and thanks, Kaylin, for this opportunity. And then I've got to say, if people have not heard the previous episode on negotiating and networking, you definitely have to hear it, especially since the interview season are on the curve, and it's going to be really helpful for you. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Kuchal, and then I'm a PGY3 resident when you're going to hear this episode, and I'm from Harlem Hospital at Columbia, and I love doing the kettlebell workout and cheering for the Knicks and also for the soccer game which is happening. And if you guys haven't visited New York, the best time I would say is when the Knicks are playing.
Congratulations. That was a really, really good series. I watched the last two games and I was like, okay, Knicks. I was so happy for everyone in New York. So to all the New Yorkers, to all the Knicks fans out there, congratulations. It's finally after how many years? Like 1970s? It was fun. It was really, really fun to see New York so lively. I love New York. It's a wonderful city. And all the photos and like videos made me so, so happy.
Are we recording? Oh, we are recording. Okay. Kaylin has joined the chat.
Kaylin, welcome, welcome. We are recording at the end of the day. So, you know, we are all a little slow to get started.
We are firing on all cylinders. So,
awesome.
Going great.
Awesome. So yeah, Rachel, thank you so much for joining us as well, our wonderful WDX team member and audio editor too. You all are so familiar with this kind of a format. Rachel is going to present Aliqua by Aliqua, and then Kaylin and I will do our best to co-discuss and, you know, figure out what's going on.
I've got a fun case for you to close your endo 30 and be happy about it. So it's going to be four Aliquas. The fourth one is going to reveal the diagnosis, and I'm going to start the first one. So on a summer day, a 35-year-old man was brought in by EMS for a fall following a witnessed convulsion. In the ED, he seized again. He was given a loading dose of Keppra. The patient is originally from Africa and moved to the United States 3 years prior, and his health checkup done for the immigration purposes was normal. He lives with his wife, who accompanied him and witnessed his seizure. The wife endorsed that the patient works in the Amazon delivery and bikes at least 30 to 40 miles a day. And this was the first time he had these seizures. The review system was negative for fever, chills, rigors, night sweats, vision disturbance, nausea, vomiting, abdominal disturbance, joint pain, weakness, numbness, tingling, rash, pruritus, excessive thirst, dysuria, and polyuria. And this is the end of the first Aliquot.
Okay, great. So I will get us started. So when I think of seizures, I think about it, you know, as a cardiologist, kind of in the same way that I think about syncope. So I think about, first of all, was it actually a seizure? So, and when I think about these events, it's super helpful that it was witnessed. I usually try to put it in terms of what happened before, during, and after. And so before, in terms of was there any sickness, what were they doing? You know, on a summer day, you always think, was it super hot? Things like that. I also think about, did they have any symptoms of infection before or anything like that? And then in terms of like right before the events, was there any kind of prodrome? Was there any kind of trigger? Was there any kind of aura? And then I think about what happened during the events. So again, we're told he had witnessed convulsions. And so his wife witnessed it, but I'd like specifically to know what it was. And, you know, if possible, sometimes when there's a witness and they record it, that's always super helpful in terms of knowing exactly what it was. Was it like whole body convulsions? Was it like rhythmic activity? And so kind of finding out what happened during the event. And then it's helpful to know what happened after the event. So was there a post-ictal period or did they recover fully afterwards? I think it can be sometimes a little hard. You know, sometimes we ask patients if they blacked out or if they remembered anything. And I think, you know, anytime you kind of black out and wake up, you can be a little bit confused. I think that's a little different from what we think of as a post-ictal period after someone had seizures. So that would be kind of how I would try to get a little bit more information about the events. And then thinking, once you think it's a true seizure, because first you want to think about other causes. You know, sometimes with syncope, people can have kind of rhythmic movement. And then there's also metabolic things like hypoglycemia, other things that can kind of mimic seizures or syncope. So kind of thinking about those other things. And then once you feel pretty confident in the seizure, then I want to think about whether it was provoked or not provoked. And so this is a 35-year-old. It sounds like previously healthy. And it doesn't sound like from what we're hearing on review systems that there was any kind of clear provoking factors. But in terms of the major things to think about would be infections, metabolic derangements, as I kind of mentioned, structural problems, like if there's any concern for any kind of tumor or anything like that. So a really good neuro exam. And then I think in terms of, you know, it doesn't say how he's doing, but I think also trying to make sure there's no kind of red flag symptoms in terms of on the neuro exams, in terms of anything that we're concerned about, meningitis or any of those symptoms. So ruling out those symptoms and trying to figure out where we are.
Ellen, are you a cardiologist or a neurologist or both?
I was like, I don't know seizures, but I know syncope. So let me just
I love that, like,
translate it.
Analogous, like, thinking. And, like, that's, like, what some great physicians and great clinical reasoners do. And that was, like, really, really awesome to listen to. And I totally agree with you. I think the question is, like, is this true seizures or syncope that can, like, they can mimic each other? And I think a lot of it from my perspective, like, as a hospitalist, I'm like, oh, this could be epilepsy. But that's not for me to determine. For me, like, similar to a syncope, is, like, for me to determine, is there any, like, reversible etiologies that has, like, led to this event? First of all, can I give this man his shout out? He's like 35 and biking 30 to 4 miles a day. I am tired even reading that. So mad respect to this person who can do that. And I think it like tells you something about his cardiovascular reserve to be able to do that. And also with that, I think some things to consider. You mentioned like his stroke, I think hypovolemia, rhabdomyolysis, like those things that can potentially cause like sort of like derangements in the form of like hyponatremia or like kidney issues that can lead to more decreasing your seizure threshold. And I think like with someone like this, I would really want to like a finger stick glucose. You always want to make sure this is not a hypoglycemic event. And then I kind of think about, you know, what metabolic derangements could lead to that. So sodium, calcium, magnesium are like the big ones that I often think about. Substances is something to ask about because one is like, okay, metabolic, what's going on in your blood that can lead to that. And the other one is like intracranial processes. And like, at least like starting with a non-con head CT to rule out any big masses, you know, just given where the patient is coming from, like things that you would consider is like a neurocysticercosis. TBR tends to be pretty big in those regions of the world. However, like you don't need to jump to any of that. This is just for funsies that I'm saying this out loud. The most important thing is like when you see this patient, you want to get that finger stick glucose, your electrolytes, your CBCs, your stromosome, a lactate. And oftentimes like trying to distinguish between whether this was a true seizure, as Kaylin mentioned, versus like a syncopal event, I think is where most of our energy goes in. And, you know, ECG, because, you know, Caitlin is watching me. we have to say that. And then I think like the first path would be a non-con hit city as well. And then that gives us a little bit more information to be able to further frame this like young guy without any like that significant medical history that we know of, who's like fairly active, who's like presenting with this like transient loss of consciousness. All right, Kushal, ready for more.
In the second aliquot, the patient had to complete 9 months of ATT for latent tuberculosis 2 years ago. And he smokes 3 to 4 cigarettes per week and smokes 1 to 2 marijuana on the other days. And he also uses cocaine at least twice a month. And his last use was the previous night. Medications, none, and family history was not relevant. And physical examination, he was afebrile, tachycardic at 111 per minute. His BP was 110 over 70 mmHg. He was breathing at 19 breaths per minute, and he was saturating at 98% in room air. On examination, he was not in distress. He was conversational, had a black eye on his right side, and he was not anemic, no icterus, no peripheral edema. His JVD was not elevated. His pupils were equal and reacting to light. Lungs were clear bilaterally. Cardiac examination, S1, S2 was heard. No murmurs, no rubs, no added sounds. Abdomen was soft, not distended, normal active bowel sounds. His extremities were warm. On neuro, he was alert, oriented, x3, and also there was no neurological focal deficits. In lab examination, the WBC was 10,000 and hemoglobin at 14.4, platelet at 235, CMP sodium was 138, potassium 4.4, chloride 100, bicarb 25, BUN was at 15, and creatinine 0.94. Anion gap was 13.8, lactate at 4, magnesium 2, phosphorus 3.5, LFTs, AST was at 63, ALT was 22, alkaline phosphatase was at 77, COVID was negative, CK was 700, UTOX was positive for cocaine, and PAN cultures were obtained. On imaging, chest X-ray was normal, EKG was normal sinus rhythm, heart rate of 110 per minute, and QTC was at 571. His imaging of his head, there was mild global parenchymal volume loss out of proportion to the patient's stated age. No large acute intraparenchymal hemorrhage, hydrocephalus, or extraaxial collection. No mass effect herniation or midline shift. Cavum septum pellucidum was present. CT maxillofacial was done, and that showed a fracture of the right orbital floor extending to the right infraorbital rim and inferiorly along the anterior wall of the right maxillary sinus. CT cervical spine showed no evidence of acute fracture or malalignment in the cervical spine. Congenital non-fusion of the posterior arch of C1 with congenital fusion across C2, C3 disc spaces and facet joints was noted. And this is the end of the second aliquot.
All right. Wow. So much great information, Kushal. Thank you so much for presenting this case and lots of good things for us to dig into. So the thing that jumped out to me were like two big things that out of all this data that really grabbed my attention. One is like a UTOX being positive for cocaine. And the second is a QTC, which I'm going to probably have Caitlin talk about that a lot more elegantly than I can. But one thing, like, it would be good to know, like, when was the last use was. But in terms of like cocaine itself, it can cause like decreased seizure threshold. It can cause like vasospasm. So this is someone that I would also like get a troponin in as well. And like cocaine can directly provoke seizures or like be another trigger if there's an underlying reason to have a seizure. So that is like something to kind of think about. I mean, the lactate of 4, the CK of 700 kind of fits well with like possible generalized tonic-clonic seizure. And maybe the fall in exertion is playing a role into that. Often times, like how fast the lactate clears is really informative. If you don't do an intervention and lactate by itself clears fast, oftentimes, you know, the muscles are from like the shaking causing the lactate
it to be elevated. And with time, the body clears it. And the other one also like the AST and ALT being like mildly elevated. I think it's just all pointing to the muscle source. The fact that, you know, the kidneys are doing okay otherwise is reassuring against like a rhabdo picture and like maybe pointing more towards possible like convulsion that we were worried about. The other thing that like grabbed my attention again, like I was like worried about like if this is someone who's going to be susceptible to seizures because of hyponatremia, like your sodium is normal, your magnesium, your lights look okay otherwise. And there's an anion gap metabolic acidosis that I'm attributing right now mostly to the lactate, but something to keep tracking as well. The QTC, oftentimes, like, you know, I think long QTC, we often worry about for SODs that can, like, lead to misinterpretation to seizures. Or, like, I wonder if the syncope plus the tonic-clonic seizure within the context of QTC raises a little bit higher on the differential as well. The one thing that you want to be, as we consult cardiology for that long QTC, aka my fave, Kaylin, I would think about, like, being very careful about not giving this patient any QT prolonging medications. Oftentimes, as you're admitting and like the order said, you have that PRN, trazodone, that Zofran, just DC those for now until we get a better sense of that. And this is someone that you want to keep the lights a K above 4 and a mag above 2 until like we get to the bottom of it. The other thing that jumped out to me was like kind of the global parenchymal volume loss that feels like a little bit out of proportion to this man's age. He's like 35 years old. So I think you can probably see in a setting of like a chronic substance use, those changes. Like HIV is a good thing to think about. So sending HIV testing, nutritional deficiency, prior CNS traumas, or like any neurodegenerative or inflammatory. We're not getting that much flavor for any inflammatory syndromes just now. That's something that I'm just going to put in the back of my brain that like, oh, there is this global loss that for me in a 35-year-old would be odd and someone that I would consider getting an MRI brain as well. Kay, what do you make of that QTC? Teach us.
Yeah, I'll just focus on the QTC since you have everything else covered.
Barely. Okay.
But, you know, a normal QTC in men is about 450. Greater than 500, we get pretty concerned. And then, you know, greater than 600 is very, very concerning. So he's quite high, 571. So I would be wondering if this was not seizures, but whether this was cardiac syncope, whether he had an arrhythmic episode. So whether, like you said, he had torsades, whether this degenerated into VF. And then I would ask a lot more questions about his personal family history. And so, you know, kind of going back to what we said before, were there any palpitations? You know, was there any thing happening before that? Was there any particular trigger that happened before during the event? What exactly does these movements look like? Because, you know, sometimes when you have syncope, you can have rhythmic movements that can mimic seizures, but it's actually syncope. Did he have, you know, incontinence? Did he have any post-ictal period afterwards? So I think really kind of going back and questioning whether or not this was seizures versus syncope. And in terms of long QTC, you know, there's different kind of categories based on the underlying genetic mutation. And then there's also kind of acquired long QTC. So as Jermaine said, medications can do it. It sounds like he's not on any medications, but going back and making sure he's not on anything, you know, over the counter, anything we're missing. And then his electrolytes. So his MAG was 2 and his K was 4.4. So we don't think that there was, you know, major like electrolyte abnormalities that trigger this. But, you know, like Charmaine was saying, kind of while we're sorting this out, I would err on the side of keeping those in the normal range or even a little bit, you know, higher, like keeping the MAG even greater than 2.2. Sometimes people even go 2.5 just to make sure we're not dipping below. And then I would ask about, you know, family history. Is there any family history of syncope, sudden cardiac death? And how I'd ask about this would be, you know, anyone who died of unknown reasons, anyone who died young, any like car accidents, things like that. So that's probably what I would start with. I think this is pretty concerning for maybe a syncopal component.
That was awesome. Okay. The last thing I totally forgot to comment on is the trauma that he has to his right orbit. I'm very curious to see how he got. I'm a total internist, right? A total hospitalist. Somebody else will think about the trauma. So I would be curious to see like how he got that black eye. Like one potential is like, oh, was it related to this activity he has? Or was it a fight or something that happened? So getting a little bit more history because like, you know,
like trauma, again, something that can cause a seizure-like activity, and like making sure we get a trauma consult, ophthalmology around that area to help us out with that, and making sure like keeping a close eye on the eye exam as we're like admitting this patient. But yeah, sorry to forgot about that. All right, back to you, Kushal.
Awesome. So his drops were negative and he did fall on his face is what the wife mentioned. And that's how he got the black eye on his right eye. So the patient was admitted to the ICU with a working diagnosis of seizure-related facial trauma with cocaine intoxication and prolonged QTC. On day one, patient was treated with scheduled doses of Keppra and Ativan PRN for seizures. And empiric treatment with Unison was also started. MRI of the brain was done, which showed no acute infarct, no midline shift, no mass, no herniation. Ventricles were stable in configuration without evidence of acute hydrocephalus. Neurology was on board. Neurosurgery and oromaxillofacial surgeons were consulted and had recommended conservative management of the right orbital floor fracture. On day 2 to 4, patient had multiple episodes of seizures. Neurology recommended to escalate the anti-epileptic meds, so valproate and fosphenytoin was added. Formal EEG was negative for epileptiform pattern. His repeat lactate was at 1, and CK had downtrended to 590, 500, and 450, and QTC repeat was at 480. So the goal was to maintain magnesium more than 2, potassium 4 to 5, and avoid all the QT prolonging drugs for him. On day 5, his cultures came back negative, so the antibiotics were discontinued. After a brief seizure-free period, patient started having recurrent seizure-like activity again. And the repeat EEG showed moderate, non-specific, diffuse or multifocal cerebral dysfunction. No epileptiform pattern or seizures were seen. Diffuse excess beta activity may be seen with medication use such as benzodiazepine or barbiturates. Neuro recommended to consult cardiology for prolonged QTC. On exam, he was AO times 1 to 2 depending on the time of the day he was examined, and chest was clear, no weakness was elicited, no new skin rash, and the prognosis was still guarded. And this ends the third aliquot, and the next would reveal the diagnosis.
Okay. I should have said this before, but given our concern for arrhythmia, this patient should be on tele. It does not seem like we have that information here, which would be really helpful to know what his rhythm is when these things are happening. So it seems like he's had repeat episodes in the hospital. He has had them while he's been on his EEG, and it sounds like while he's had these seizures, I guess the question is he having any seizures while the EEG is on? Because if the formal EEG is saying it's negative for a leptiform pattern while he's clinically having a seizure, then that's helpful. I guess if he's, you know, not having, like, I guess, what we're calling seizures, clinical seizures, then, you know, we might just not be capturing it. Okay, yeah. So then it sounds like after a brief seizure-free period, he started having recurrent seizure-like activity, and then the repeat EEG again, no epileptic form pattern or seizures were seen. So again, it's seeing like we're capturing kind of what's happening on the EEG while he's having these seizure-like episodes, and it doesn't seem like neurologically there's an explanation. I don't know enough neurology to know what the negative predictive value is for an EEG, so that would be something to know. But if we're assuming that this is less likely a seizure, then I would say, again, syncope is very high on the differential, and this patient should definitely have been on tele to see what's happening. I think the fact that the repeat EKG, you know, 480 is still long, you know, it is helpful to repeat, I mean, many tests, but especially QT, because I think after someone has an acute event, like if they've had syncope for another reason, or initially they can have a transiently prolonged QTC, the fact that it's still 480, you know, I guess this is in the setting of all the seizures, but it seems like it, at least we have 2 time points where it's still prolonged. So I would definitely have this patient on telemetry. And the other thing to consider is if your suspicion is high enough, like if neurology is like, we definitely don't think this is seizure, whether you would do something like prophylactically treat him for long QT syndrome. And in this case, it would be something like a beta blocker. So oftentimes we'll do Nadolol because it's a long acting beta blocker. So that's one. And then two is, you know, this is not going to happen immediately, but getting genetic testing in him to see if we can find the genetic mutation. And then I guess depending on how long these are happening, you know, I think it'll be important to diagnose if these are arrhythmias, because then you would need to do something like an ICD. It seems like what we should do is I would definitely have him on telly. And, you know, it sounds like he's having enough of these that something should be reviewed. But even if not, I would consider starting a beta blocker on him to try to get ahead of these. He's having kind of repeat events at this point, and it sounds like it's more concerning for cardiac than neuro at this point.
Yeah, I totally agree with you, Kay, because, you know, I think like when he first came in with like he used like cocaine the night before, I think you can say like, oh, like cocaine induced seizure, sure, within a time frame like 2 to 5 days afterwards. That is very odd. And then the other thing is like not responding to all of these anti-epileptic therapies and an EEG being negative. I think like neurology has done a really great job of like trying to be like, hey, I don't think this is seizure. So I totally agree with you in kind of like framing this as like an arrhythmia masquerading as a seizure, basically. Before like going down that path, there are things that you want to make sure, like, you know, you can always make sure to like get a valproate level, get a phenytoin level, like make sure, you know, he doesn't have elevated ammonia that affects like valproate. So there's like, you know, the platelets, liver. So you always want to make sure your due diligence is that it's not because of any reason why this patient is not responding to treatment. But with a negative EEG, again, it would be very highly unlikely. Then I think the question becomes like, okay, if this is not seizure, as you mentioned, Kay, this is either convulsive syncope or like a functional neurological disease. And I think the functional neurological disease is always going to be a diagnosis of exclusion, especially when we know there is an abnormality in the long QTC. I guess I think a thought exercise that would be good for us to go through is like, what causes kind of the long QT, as you mentioned, like the genetic component of it. So I think like, correct me if I'm wrong, I often think about, as you mentioned, like the acquired drug induced, like I would be careful with like antibiotics, especially like he was empirically treated that could affect the QTC, like antipsychotic, antidepressant, antiemetic, antifungal. The list is long and long and long. And then like electrolyte abnormalities, we talked about substance uses. And then I think the part that I would love your help with is like, is there any other cardiac diseases, like structural heart diseases, K, that is like associated with long QT? Like, is this, it doesn't sound like Kushal had any murmurs or anything, but is it like worth getting an echo to evaluate like a structural? And I think like the telly makes a lot of sense to capture that. So, but I don't know if there's any cardiomyopathies that have like long QTC as part of their illness scripts.
Yeah, I can't think of any one off the top of my head. I mean, I think we get an echo for much less. So I think it would be fine in this patient who has some concern for arrhythmias to get an echo, if not for, you know, something, a cardiomyopathy associated on QTC, but if he's having a lot of arrhythmias and things like that, just to get a sense of his function. There are like syndromes that are associated with long QTC. And so I think that's something also worth considering. I think that just requires a more kind of detailed kind of personal and family history. And I think we have to get a little bit more information. You know, I think if we get the genetic testing, there's a specific mutation that we can see if there's some associations there. But I would say, you know, there's no particularly structural heart disease I think of, but I think it would be important, anyone who we're considering like cardiac causes of syncope, to get an echo just to make sure we're not missing anything else.
Yeah, that sounds good. I think like the next article will reveal the diagnosis. I don't know, other than like it's probably cardiac etiology of this and like perhaps a long QTC playing a role. But honestly, at this
point for their cardiac workup, like with a tele, probably Zyopasha discharge, an echocardiogram is like what we would do. And then I think like one thing that would be very helpful, like sometimes like using your treatment as a diagnostic tool. And if, you know, as Kay mentioned, if you start treating the long QT and he no longer has any of those episodes, then you kind of have your answers because we haven't really done anything else. And like supporting him through his journey of like, you know, a substance use disorder, and making sure, you know, we take that variable out. I'm just rambling on. Any other thoughts, Kay?
Yeah, the other thing that I was thinking about as we were reading the article, and then I kind of forgot, but is that, you know, he's ANO times 1 to 2. I guess I'm a little bit curious about that. You know, is he like encephalopathic? Is he, yeah, I don't know what's going on there. So I think that's probably worth finding a little bit more information, because I think anyone can be confused if they're passing out after having seizures, but if he's kind of consistently confused, that wouldn't be as consistent with cardiac syncope. So I think that might be an additional layer as we're thinking about other things we're not missing or inciting events. And, you know, there are some abnormalities in terms of like there was more brain volume loss than expected and things like that. So I would say that being ANO times 1 to 2, I don't think we can quite explain that.
Yeah, that's a really, really good point. I think one question I would have for neurologists is kind of the dosing of like his antiepileptics, and like Valpro at that times can have some sedating effects, if I remember correctly. So is it just like a medication side effect? So if I think like one thing that would be also helpful with neurology is that like if we don't think this is seizure, just like pulling off those medications, although that is perhaps a bold thing to do to see where his mental status is at. And I think like then the question becomes like, oh, removing what you think is the potential insult and then kind of doing the altered mental status workup. That is already a lot of it have been done. So then the question again becomes like, is this someone that needs an LP? Are we dealing with that kind of encephalitis type picture? And I think that's a good discussion with neurology. But I think like one thing I would do like valproate is the one that I would worry most in this situation. So you can like check an ammonia level, valproate level, like LFTs and phenytoin as well. Like all of them can cause neurotoxicity. So there's a situation that I can imagine that, you know, he's not responding, that we're increasing the doses of this and then we're causing like more encephalopathy more than anything else. And then the other thing, the EEG would be interesting. Sometimes like you have slowing when people are truly like encephalopathic. So that's the other thing that I would worry about, and being in the ICU with like ICU delirium. And I think, yeah, like one thing you don't want to miss is doing an LP to make sure we have addressed that. So I think at this point we have more questions than answers, but so we're really, really excited to hear, Kushal, what happened next.
Awesome. And so he was still in the ICU all the day, all the time, and he was on tele also. But in our ICU, we do take the EKG, the physical strip, even when the patient is on tele monitoring. But just the frequency with which they would have to do it would become reduced. And we did send out for the cytochrome P2C9 that was negative, and also to just make sure he was not metabolizing the anti-epileptic medications fast and they were never reaching the therapeutic levels. So the drug levels were themselves measured and they were all also within the therapeutic range. So the neurologist mentioned that his alert and orientation 1 to 2 was probably because of him being on so many anti-epileptic medications and around the clock. Also, at that particular point, the concern was more that he should be seizure-free, especially since he's got so much of volume loss in imaging, which was not consistent with his age. So it wasn't more to just make sure that he's oriented and alert all the times to 3. We did go ahead and do an echo, and that showed a severe concentric left ventricular hypertrophy, and there was a systolic anterior motion with resting left ventricular outflow tract, a peak gradient at 45 mmHg at 82 beats per minute, no regional wall motion abnormalities, no normal right ventricular size and systolic function, no significant valvular stenosis or regurgitation. Findings raise suspicion for infiltrative or deposit disease cardiomyopathy mimicking HOCM versus non-ischemic cardiomyopathy. Recommended further evaluation with cardiac MRI and genetic testing. Did you want to share any final thoughts before I give you the case conclusion?
go ahead, tell us the case. I think we're still thinking, so we'll definitely have some comments afterwards.
For sure. So the patient continued to have seizure-like activity and the cardiologist deferred any further testing and decided to place the ICD. And since the placement of the ICD, patient has been seizure-free. And his final diagnosis was HOCM with severe outflow tract obstruction, likely causing cardiac seizure due to malignant arrhythmia. And why were the arrhythmias not captured on telemetry monitoring? Several factors can cause them to be missed, including brief duration or the noise from the physical movement.
Wow, what a case. Okay, what are your thoughts?
So for hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, so it's a clinical diagnosis. So meaning you have to exclude kind of any loading conditions like hypertension or things like that that can cause hypertrophy. There's different kind of phenotypes. So there's, you know, kind of what we classically think of as like septal hypertrophy, but you can have apical, you can have just kind of different morphologies. In this situation, he has severe concentric LVH and he has an outflow tract obstruction. And so just to know that an outflow tract obstruction is not specific to HCM. So you can have severe LVH, for example, from hypertension, then, you know, you can have LVOT obstruction. It's not necessarily specific. You know, in this situation, a cardiac MRI would be helpful. I mean, it doesn't sound like we know that there's a history of longstanding hypertension. It sounds like there is a concern that he might have some kind of infiltrative disease, just given how thick the walls are. So all of those things would need to be kind of evaluated, I think, before we can say for sure that it's hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. I think genetic testing, again, would be helpful if there's a concern. I think regardless, he has underlying structural heart disease, and he has these episodes. So I would say in terms of further workup, I think a cardiac MRI is definitely helpful. I think HCM is on the differential, but I agree that other non-ischemic cardiomyopathies are still on the differential. And I think, you know, just because we have LVOT obstruction doesn't mean that it's HCM, and especially in the setting of severe concentric LVH, we have to rule out the other things. With that being said, you know, there's certain cardiomyopathies that increase your risk of arrhythmias, and HCM is one of them. You know, sarcoid can certainly do it as well. And so based on if there is any delayed gadolinium enhancement, the pattern of that, that can be helpful. And then there's also kind of other tests that we can do to kind of try to hone in on that diagnosis, whether that's being a PYP scan for amyloid or a CT PET for sarcoid. So I think, you know, additional imaging and then genetic testing would be helpful in terms of diagnostic. In terms of treatment, I think we'd have to look at the strips from the events. You know, he's had multiple events, so maybe he just had like a lot of artifacts and it's just really hard to read overall. But, you know, I would go back and just really see if we can find anything on those strips that are suggestive, because if they really do look normal, then I think that would not be as consistent. And then, you know, once you put in an ICD, you can see what's going on. So I think it's one thing if he's having events and then the ICD, you know, either paces him out of it or shocks him. And it's something different if he just is not having any events, you know, because an ICD is not changing his heart rate and shortening his QT or something like that. So I would say it's not clear yet whether or not he's still having arrhythmias that are being treated versus he's not having arrhythmias. And I don't know that putting in the ICD and not seeing any more arrhythmias is necessary diagnostic. So I think I would have further questions about that. And I think a beta blocker is still good. Anyone who you're concerned about an arrhythmia in, a beta blocker is fine. I mean, it's, you know, low risk. The biggest thing is, you know, some patients can feel more tired or fatigued. He might not feel as great on his 30 to 40 mile bike rides, but I think that's otherwise fine. So I would say for him, next steps would be cardiac MRI, genetic testing, and then just really interrogating the ICD and kind of seeing what his rhythms are on that. And then I would go ahead and treat him with a beta blocker.
because there's enough going on that you're concerned. The only thing I would caution with a beta blocker is that some patients with restrictive disease don't really tolerate it very well. So if he really has more of like an infiltrative restrictive disease, he might actually feel terrible on it. So that's why I feel like now that we have this ICD, I would make sure that we think it's actually arrhythmias. I think it's a very high suspicion given his underlying structural heart disease, but there's still a couple loose ends, I would say, that don't quite all tie together nicely yet.
Question for you, Kaylin. So what do you think could have precipitated this to occur in this patient after, you know, multiple, I'm sure, months or years of the 30 to 40 mile bike rides? Like, why is this happening to him now if he had underlying HOCM?
Yeah, so patients with HOCM have a higher risk of sudden cardiac death, and it's not necessarily tied to their functional status or triggers like exercise. So there are certain arrhythmias like catecholamergic polymorphic VT, where it's more like exercise or adrenergic. There are certain subtypes of long QT where it's usually some kind of adrenergic surge. So that can certainly be like a trigger in someone who's susceptible. But in HCM, they don't necessarily have to have poor functional status or anything to be at risk for sudden cardiac death. And so when we kind of risk stratify these patients for sudden cardiac death, so age is a big one. You know, if you've made it to like your 60s and 70s and you haven't had an event, chances are, you know, lower that you will. The thickness, your LV thickness. So depending on how thick his wall is, the left atrial size, so kind of how much remodeling there's been, any history of syncope, any family history of syncope, and then when you do the cardiac MRI, kind of the degree of delayed gadolinium enhancement. So these are the things that we look at. So it's not necessarily kind of their functional status or their triggers, but it's kind of their underlying structural heart disease, as well as their underlying risk factors being age and personal and family history.
Yeah, I totally agree. I'm very curious to see what the ICD interrogation shows, because I'm like, is he just getting shocked out of these? And that would be very uncomfortable for him. So that's not a good place to be. Or is he just like getting paced out of them if this is arrhythmia? Or is there something else going on that we just haven't captured? And sometimes, like, you know, close follow-up and time is your friend. Like, this is the first time he's presenting with us. Was it something that we just didn't catch? Or is this like a beginning of something that is going to be more recurrent? And now we're in a much better place to get more data. We know what his heart structure is, they're getting the cardiac MRI, and like really keeping a close eye on that ICD. And like, METOP sounds great. I love METOP. All right, Kushal. Any other thoughts, Kaylin, Kushal?
No, I mean, yeah, this was a great case. I think just showing to keep your differential broad, and that, you know, like when I think about syncope, I think about the mimickers before I go down that route. So thinking about things that can be mimickers of seizures. So I think of those buckets like seizures, syncopes, and like metabolic disturbances when I think about this. So yeah, and I guess echo first, you know.
We love echoes. All right, Kushal, I think you have some teaching points for us as well.
Awesome. So he's on Cardizem and he's on also the beta blocker. And I was going through his chart and then it seems to be like he's come a couple of times to the ED because of the ICD firing. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, the ICD is not MRI compatible. So we are not able to proceed to do an MRI for him, though that's something which the cardiologist has recommended and would like to have it if possible. So the teaching points is like, which I do have, is like differentiating a left ventricular outflow tract obstruction as either fixed or dynamic entities are critical for management. And this is best demonstrated via invasive hemodynamics. And broken Burrow sign is the post-PVC beat demonstrates a diagnostic paradox when the left ventricular systolic pressure spikes, but aortic pressure drops due to worsening dynamic obstruction. In case of a fixed obstruction like aortic stenosis, offers uniform resistance, while dynamic obstruction like HOCM worsens during mid to late systole as cavity size decreases. The dynamic rule: avoid anything that decreases the preload, decreases the afterload, or increases its contractility, as these factors can worsen the outflow tract obstruction. So remember that the dynamic left ventricular outflow tract obstruction is not exclusive for HOCM. It also occurs in post-mitral valve repair, during stress cardiomyopathy, and in apical infarctions with hyperkinetic basal segments. physical examination clues would be a harsh crescendo-decrescendo murmur, uniquely louder with well silver or standing because it decreases the preload, and softer with squatting because it increases the preload and afterload. On echo, look for a late peaking dagger-shaped continuous wave Doppler, which envelopes across the left ventricular outflow tract. So let's just circle back to what's happening to our patient. He had an undetected LVH and severe dehydration, which lowered his preload, and use of cocaine, which increased his contractility, which likely precipitated his severe LOT, left ventricular outflow tract obstruction, and also subsequent malignant arrhythmias. The clinical pitfall in patients with undifferentiated shock and dynamic left ventricular outflow tract obstruction, standard ACLS inotropes like epinephrine or dobutamine will worsen the obstruction. So the management would require aggressive volume resuscitation and beta block.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Kushal, for presenting such an interesting and fascinating case. Really, really appreciate it. Love your cases. Come back often, friend. It's always fun to get to learn cardiology from Kaylin and from your cases. So thanks for that. And Kaylin, do you want to just close us out?
Yeah. Okay. So I Googled long QT syndrome and hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, and it apparently 13% of patients with HCM can have QTC prolongation. And then the other cardiomyopathy, which now that I think about it anecdotally, I have seen is Takotsubo cardiomyopathy. Wow. Can cause acquired long QT. And again, it's acquired. So both of these are supposed to be transient. The Takotsubo is supposed to be transient. And so kind of monitoring the QT with that. But yeah, they're at more risk for towards odds kind of when that QTC is prolonged. And then the QTC prolongation with cardiotrophic cardiomyopathy, I'll have to look into that more in terms of, I don't think we take it into account like in our risk score and things like that with patients' underlying QT is when you risk stratify them. So it's a little hard to know kind of how that modifies their risk, if it does.
Medicine, so much to learn. Cardiology, yeah. So much to learn that oftentimes involves me just texting Kaylin.
Wow. Look at us talking about seizures. I did really like neurology as a medical student.
Yeah. You're pretty good at everything, Kaylin.
I liked neurology. I thought it was pretty fun to localize the lesion.
Yeah. It is it's a very, very cool field. I know. I wish I was better at it. All right, everyone. Thanks so much for joining us for another episode. Thank you, Rachel. Thanks, Kushal.
Bye,
love
everyone.
With you, Kay. Bye.
That's a wrap, everyone. Thanks for tuning in.
If you enjoyed this episode and want to be part of our community, join us for our live virtual morning report, where you can present the case or discuss with us. Visit our website for details. We would love to have you.